Fiona Kelly is here with what it says in Wednesday's papers.
The pictures which dominate your front pages this morning are of the aftermath of the Taliban massacre on a school in Pakistan yesterday, in which 132 children and 9 teachers lost their lives. Injured children in their school uniforms feature in the front of the Irish Independent, Irish Daily Star and Irish Sun, while the Irish Times and Irish Daily Mirror both run with shots of a group of grief-stricken women mourning over the body of 15-year-old Muhammad Ali Khan, who was killed in yesterday's massacre. The picture in the front of today's Irish Examiner, meanwhile, is of candles being lit at a vigil in Karachi last night. The phrase slaughter of the innocents is one which is used in a number of this morning's headlines, but that phrase is also put in context by Robert Fisk in a piece in The Independent this morning, in which he attempts to explain how the relationship between the Pakistan Army, the Inter-Services Intelligence Security Police and the Taliban has fueled such a cruel conflict in this corner of the old British Empire. While the pictures in the front of this morning's papers are all generated by the massacre in Pakistan, most of the lead stories focus on matters domestic. The Times leads with the line that the ESRI has voiced concern over moves made by the central bank to restrict mortgage lending because it could curtail the supply of new homes. For its lead story, The Independent reports that Gardaí are targeting gangs behind a spike in burglaries around the country in a pre-Christmas clampdown. Paul Williams reports that Gardaí carried out a dawn raid on a traveller site in Blackrock in Dublin yesterday. 2 men were arrested and are due to appear in court in Dunleary this morning after a number of stolen items were recovered. For Radcliffe, abortion laws are far too restrictive. That's the lead headline in this morning's Examiner, a story which you'll also just have heard about in the Bulletin. The paper reports on comments made by the Minister for Health during a debate about a call to repeal the Eighth Amendment, which he said continues to exert a chilling effect on doctors. Difficult decisions that should be made by women and their doctors, a couple or the next of kin, where there is no capacity and on the basis of best clinical practice, are now made on foot of legal advice. That isn't how it should be, the Minister remarked. The Irish Daily Mail leads today with a story about the appointment of the former chairman of Young Fine Gael in Castlebar, 25-year-old Dara Loftus, to the board of Sulis, which is the new educational and training agency introduced by the government to replace FOSS. The paper reports that Mr. Loftus, who seconded the Taoiseach's election nomination in 2011 and is a neighbour of his in Mayo, was appointed despite not making it onto the shortlist of the 20 most suitable candidates put forward by a selection committee for the Department of Education. Boy 13 charged with knife murder. That's the lead headline on the front of today's Irish Daily Mirror, which reports on the murder of 53-year-old Jack Barry from Cove in County Cork in London on Sunday night, which you'll also just have heard about in the Bulletin. Elsewhere on the front pages, The Times and Examiner both report on how Brazil's Supreme Court has cleared the way for the extradition of fugitive former solicitor Michael Lynn back to Ireland. And The Examiner also has front page stories about how threatened cuts to Ireland's fish catch were averted at the year-end agreement on fish quotas, much to the relief of Fisheries Minister Simon Coveney. And there's also a report there from Anne Cattle about 80 bills which are to be withdrawn, which caused uproar in the European Parliament, including one which proposed that paid maternity leave should be scrapped. But finally, the Mail and Independent both reported today that there may indeed be life on Mars. We're told that a NASA robot patrolling the surface of Mars has detected what are described as burps of methane.
Fiona, thanks very much. It's time for our first look at the business news this Wednesday morning. Good morning, Brian Finn.
Audrey, thank you. Good morning. The Russian ruble settled a bit overnight after the currency went into virtual free fall yesterday. It ended the day at 68 to the dollar, having fallen as low as 80 to the dollar after an interest rate hike by the Russian Central Bank on Monday night from 10.5% to 17% just served to spread panic across markets. The Russian currency has lost 20% of its value since the start of the week and is down more than 50% this year. The economy minister said that the government would not impose restrictions on Russians, preventing them from converting local cash into dollars. However, currency traders are reporting that demand for foreign exchange is 3 to 4 times normal levels at the moment. And on top of that, foreign exchange brokers in London and New York are no longer taking ruble trades. The Russian situation is having a knock-on effect outside of its own borders. Global stocks are down, with all the main indices in the US closing lower last night. Asian stocks recorded some gains overnight as investors appear to be getting in on a wave of bargain hunting. Emerging markets are also feeling the heat. The Indonesian central bank was forced to prop up the rupiah yesterday after it sank to a 16-year low. The US Federal Reserve starts its final policy meeting of the year tonight. A signal on interest rate hikes could put those economies under more pressure by sucking capital back into the US. And oil prices, one of the factors exacerbating the Russian situation, fell further yesterday. Brent crude, one of the key oil price measures, fell to below $55.50 overnight. In other news this morning, the travel booking website lastminute.com has been sold to Swiss travel firm Bravofly Rumbo for £76 million. The website was founded by tech entrepreneurs Martha Lane Fox and Brent Hoberman in October 1998, but was sold to US tech firm Sabre Holdings 10 years ago in a deal valuing the company at nearly $600 million. Sabre says it now wants to focus on its other technology businesses. Finally, currencies this morning. The euro is trading at $1.24.8 and 79.4 pence sterling, Rachel.
Thank you very much, Brian. First of all, this morning we're going to go to Brussels, where fisheries ministers have agreed quotas for the next year. The Federation of Irish Fishermen says the outcome is a mixed bag for this country, with increases for a number of stocks, including prawns, but cuts to the amounts of haddock, cod and whiting to be caught in the Celtic Sea. The Minister for Agriculture, Food and the Marine, Simon Coveney, joins us now on the line from Brussels. Good morning.
Morning, Rachel. Thanks for having me on.
What, if any, difference will these new quotas make to the Irish fisheries industry over the next year?
Well, first of all, I think people need to understand the context behind these negotiations, because 3 days ago, the Commission were proposing very, very substantial cuts to Irish fish quotas for next year that would have resulted in fishermen's incomes in the whitefish area, which is the vast majority of fishermen, of in and around €20 million. And actually, the result that we now have is that incomes in the whitefish sector will probably increase slightly by a million or €2 million or so next year. So the real concern going into these negotiations, because of what was being proposed by the Commission in terms of precautionary cuts mainly to multiple fish stocks, we've managed on the basis of science and hard argument and a really good team of people with us from the Marine Institute as well as the Department of Marine to change the Commission's mind on that, and I think we now have a reasonable outcome. It's not an outcome that is all good news for everybody. In the Celtic Sea, which is in the south coast of Ireland, we have quite a complex mixed fishery there of cod, haddock and whiting. And the proposals coming into these negotiations was that we would see a 64% cut in the cod quota there. What we've come out with now is a 13% cut, which is, you know, a massive improvement on what was there. But most importantly, it still stands up from a science point of view.
Not everybody is convinced about that. The environmental pillar, which, as you know, represents a number of environmental groups, favours larger cuts, which it says are necessary to slow the decline of the populations of these fish.
Yeah, well, I was just going to answer that because if you look at that fishery, for example, what the industry has agreed to do now is to effectively change the way in which they fish that fishery. They're now going to introduce new gear which allows small fish and juvenile fish to escape. So they're introducing what's called a 120-millimeter square mesh panel, which is a technical term essentially for an escape hatch within nets, to allow all of the small fish escape, which scientists say will reduce the amount of discarding and unwanted bycatch by between 30 and 40%.
You say you are taking that seriously and that there will be changes. On the question of the discards, there has been a lot of controversy, as people will know, over fishermen having to throw part of their catch back into the sea. Has that situation been resolved?
Yes, and it's been resolved because of Irish initiative. A big priority for me in the new Common Fisheries Policy was that we would end discarding. This idea, which has been a consequence of EU policy for many years now, whereby if a fisherman catches a fish that it doesn't have a quota for, it simply he has to throw the fish back into the sea dead. That makes no sense from a sustainability point of view. It certainly makes no sense from a food security point of view either. I mean, in some of these fisheries, we would have seen 40 or 50% of the fish caught thrown back dead because there wasn't a quota to land them into port. We've now totally changed the way in which quota will be calculated. That's being introduced now in the pelagic side, which is mackerel and horse mackerel and herring, for next year, and it'll be introduced in 12 months' time into the whitefish sector, which is everything from cod to haddock to whiting to hake to monk fish to megrim and so on.
Right, but so, the changes will start in January.
Yes, they will. So, like, we are fundamentally changing the way in which the fishing industry operates, whereby two big changes. First of all, we'll be setting quotas on the basis of what's called maximum sustainable yield, which is now an internationally recognized way of allowing fishermen to get the maximum commercial return they can from fishing a stock while not undermining the viability of that stock. And secondly, we are ending discards, which means we're requiring fishermen to land everything they catch. And those two big changes require the fishing industry to be part of that change. And we need to help them do that. We need to finance them in those changes and help them make those policy changes, which is exactly what's happening at the moment. And that is why the result of these negotiations was so important. Because at a time when you're trying to ask the industry to make fundamental changes, you can't take all their fish away from them either.
All
so
right.
The biggest whitefish fishery in Ireland is prawns, which represents €60 million of value to the industry each year. That quota was to be reduced by 14% by the Commission. It's now going to be increased by 3% next year.
All
so
right.
it's, so you've on got, the whole, it's a very positive outcome.
You've got an increase there. Just on another European-related matter, if you would, the European Central Bank won't be attending the banking inquiry, we've learned today. Mario Draghi saying the bank does not see itself in a position to participate in inquiries conducted by national parliaments. Is this snub acceptable?
I don't think it's acceptable. I think this is the wrong decision by the ECB. We're setting up a banking inquiry involving all political parties so that we can get a detailed understanding and explanation of what has happened in banking over the last 5 to 10 years, because it has had a huge impact on the lives of Irish people. And whether the ECB like it or not, they were part of that story. And they have an obligation, in my view, to be part of the explanation for what unfolded in banking over the last 10 years.
But there's nothing that the inquiry team can do about this, is there?
I expect that the chairman, Ciarán Lynch, will write to the ECB and will ask them to reconsider, and I certainly hope they will reconsider.
Simon Coveney, thank you for joining us on the line from Brussels.
The people of Peshawar in North Pakistan have begun burying their children after yesterday's massacre at a school for the sons and daughters of military personnel. 132 boys and girls, some as young as 10, were murdered by the Pakistani Taliban. 9 of their teachers also died. Mourners crowded around coffins bedecked with flowers, while other families waited at hospitals, still trying to find out if their children are alive or dead. This woman told how her friend's daughter had gone into the boys' part of the school to find her brother.
But all of a sudden, since the Taliban, those terrorists, they noticed that a girl had entered the building, they started, you know, firing gunshots again. And she was caught amidst that firing. And all of a sudden, all her clothes were washed up in blood. And she was wise enough to pretend that she was dead so that they turned their attention away. And they moved into another classroom. And this is how she managed to escape, because they thought she was dead and she managed to escape from the back door. But she went there to get her brother, and there's still no news of him. She couldn't find him.
Well, just before we came on air, we got through to Peshawar and I spoke to journalist Gossam Nauman. He told me what had been happening over the past few hours there.
Peshawar today woke up after the incredible tragedy of yesterday with a sense of almost numb and quiet over the city. Many businesses in some of the city's biggest markets are closed. Most schools are closed. In fact, according to an announcement by the provincial government, all schools will be closed for 3 days in mourning. The funerals for the victims of yesterday's Taliban attack have begun. Some children have been buried, and these funerals have been thronged by not only family and loved ones, but also by well-wishers from the neighborhoods across the city, classmates. Heartbreaking scenes that are expected to continue further into the day as one more such funerals are held.
And are people, they're clearly in mourning, are they still very much in shock as well that an attack of this magnitude could happen against their children?
Indeed, there is a sense of shock that still hasn't subsided, which is an important thing to consider because Peshawar is not unfamiliar with such terrorist attacks. In fact, since the beginning of the war in Afghanistan in 2001, the city has seen dozens, if not hundreds, of attacks of all kinds. But the fact that the Taliban went after a school, attacked children, and killed over 100 of them has left the city that is so used to pain in shock.
It's far from clear the relationship between the military, the intelligence service, the government and many aspects of the Taliban. In many cases, the Taliban are used by the authorities as assets in some cases.
That indeed is a narrative that that prevails in many parts of Pakistan and its classes. But you know, when we spoke to people on the street, to students of all ages, of parents, this did not come up. In fact, there was almost universal support for the military to go against the Taliban, and we didn't. At least in the last 48 hours, we haven't got the impression that the people are. Of the city are in any way confused about the link between the two or any kind of collusion.
So you're getting a clear message that the people there want the army to continue their attacks against the Taliban. They don't think that what happened yesterday was too high a price to pay for taking this action against the militants.
Indeed, everyone we've spoken to, everyone we've heard, in fact, every voice in this country at the moment, at least in the mainstream, is united in calling for action against the militants. And the narrative as far as the price is concerned is interesting because it's what people are saying now is that this is too high a price to pay, and this is not a price that we want to pay again, which is all the more reason for the government and the military to take even more intense action against these militant groups.
The Taliban say that they did what they did yesterday in direct retaliation for these army attacks against their people, and they say their children have been killed as well in those attacks. Is that the case?
It's almost impossible to verify these claims because the areas in which the military operation is taking place is off limits to journalists. So what you have are two competing sets of claims. Where the army claims that it carries out precise strikes with the intent is to minimize collateral damage, while the Taliban claim that very few of their members have been killed and most of those who have been victim to the army's aerial and ground attacks have been innocent people.
Just finally, Gossam, do you believe that this attack is a turning point for Pakistan?
Well, it's difficult to say. It certainly appears that way in the initial 24 hours after this attack happened. But we've seen the church bombing in the same city last year where over 100 people were massacred by Taliban suicide bombers. We saw the airport attack in Karachi, which was brazen and audacious, also killed dozens of people. So we've had several of these attacks. But what seems different this time is the fact that children were killed by Taliban mercilessly, methodically. The bodies were on camera, seen by everyone in the country who had access to a television. So there does seem to be the kind of unified consensus against the Taliban that we haven't seen in a while. So it could prove to be a turning point, but again, that's something that, of course, would play out over the next few weeks and months.
That was journalist Gossam Nauman talking to me a little bit earlier from Peshawar in Pakistan.
Brazil's Supreme Court has cleared the way for the former solicitor Michael Lynn to be returned to Ireland. Mr. Lynn faces a string of charges relating to the collapse of his property empire back in 2007. On the line from Brasilia is Tom Hennigan. He's the Latin America correspondent for the Irish Times. Tom, will you remind us, for how long has Michael Lynn been living in Brazil?
He arrived in Brazil by the end of 2011 when he started registering his property. He bought a property in the suburb of Sao Paulo. We know he was definitely in the country with his wife by 2012. They had a child here, which secured them permanent residency. And he was living, teaching English in the city of Recife in the northeast of the country, quietly until August of last year, when he was arrested by Brazilian police on foot of an arrest warrant from Interpol.
Bring us forward then to yesterday. What reasons did the judges give for their decision?
It was actually quite a resounding victory for the Irish authorities. The court accepted their claim that there was more than enough evidence to charge Michael Lynn in Ireland with a series of crimes. Because of the differences between the Brazilian and the Irish legal system, some of the charges that the Irish authorities had presented to Brazil were left out of the extradition. That is, that when if the Irish government accept the conditions of the court, they will not be able to process Lynn for forgery or false representation of documents. But on the main charges that he was basically involved in theft, that they can process him for that. And the Irish government had spent a long and detailed process putting together the case against Lynn, and having put it together, then translating it into a form that the Brazilian authorities could accept. Because number one, Brazil is a very different legal system to Ireland, and number two, there's no extradition treaty between the two countries. Lynn's defence tried to say that the Irish had made many errors, that the case that was being presented against Lynn did not hold up under Brazilian law, but the court threw out those arguments.
Is there any further line of appeal open to Michael Lynn, or is this the end of the line?
This is the end of the line. It's Brazil's top court. The vote was unanimous. It was a panel of four judges. Typically there was five, but one was absent. So the four judges all unanimously voted to extradite him. What his defence can do is, the judgment was published by the Supreme Court overnight. They now have 5 working days in which they can ask the court for clarification on the decision. But all that would do is delay Lynn's return to Ireland and prolong his stay in what is quite a grim, overcrowded Brazilian prison. There's no way he can actually appeal the decision. He can just ask for clarification on why the Supreme Court has decided to send him back to Ireland.
When is he likely to be on his way back to Ireland then?
In Brazil, you always have to be careful, particularly in legal matters, about putting any kind of hard deadlines on decisions like this. But the lawyer representing the Irish government after the case said that while it was unlikely he would return before the end of the year, he thought that it was more than reasonable to expect by the end of January, he would be sent back to Ireland.
Tom, thank you very much. Tom Hennigan there, who's the Latin America correspondent for the Irish Times.
Darren Frehill is here. Darren, some sad news in the GAA world this morning.
Yes, Audrey, very good morning. The Dublin County Board chairman, Andy Kettle, has died after losing his battle with cancer. Now, he was 68 years of age and he had served 4 years in the office. He was re-elected for a 5th term only last Monday. During his time as chairman, Dublin enjoyed tremendous success on and off the field. The footballers won 2 All-Ireland Senior Football titles, and the hurlers claimed a first league Division 1 title in 60 years and a first Leinster title in 40. Andy Kettle, hugely popular figure in the GAA world, no stranger to this particular programme.
This is it. He's one of those people who, on good days and bad, always came on,
you took the words out of my mouth.
Yeah, but it's true, isn't it? And you know, those people can be few and far between at times. And he was a wonderful man to come on the bad day. He never ducked or dived.
Absolutely. He always answered the call. And the Dublin football manager, Jim Gavin, will be joining us to pay him tribute later in the show. Galway attacker Sean Armstrong has announced his retirement from inter-county football. This is a surprising one. Just 29 years of age, he's been involved with the Tribesmen for the last decade, widely regarded as a great talent, and we all remember he scored that hat-trick in the 2005 under-21 All-Ireland final win against Down. He won 2 Connacht titles in his time with Galway. Alan Dillon has committed himself to the Mayo Footballers for another season. The 32-year-old has made a senior debut back in 2003. Now, there was a big shock in the English League Cup last night. League One side Sheffield United beat the Premier League outfit Southampton 1-0. Mark McNulty scored the only goal of the game. Chelsea are also through to the semi-finals. They beat Derby 3-1. Eden Hazard, Philippe Luis and André Schürrle scored the goals. The Chelsea manager is Jose Mourinho.
They are a championship side, but not a typical championship side. They have more quality than that, so they play good football. They have fantastic support by their stadium, and we knew that was going to be difficult. But I think we played in a very professional way, and we controlled the game for most of the time. But I have to be fair with them and say that they fought till the end, and especially a few minutes after they score their goal, they were able to put us in trouble.
Now the semi-final lineup will be completed later this evening. Newcastle travel to Tottenham. Bournemouth host Liverpool, and the Liverpool manager Brendan Rodgers has dismissed talk of dressing room unrest at Anfield. His side are 11th in the league table, and they're already out of the Champions League. One of the big games in the Guinness Pro 12 this coming weekend will see Leinster host an informed Connacht. History says Leinster will be favourites on Friday night, but Connacht are coming off some terrific form recently, including that victory away to Bayonne at the weekend with a weakened side. Their coach is Pat Lamb.
We go into a situation where we've never won before, and you know, we've never ever done back-to-back on Leinster ever before as well, so you can see the challenge we face. And but we're excited by it, but we also know what a quality side Leinster are, and it's not easy. I mean, they are the most successful team, and you know, recently in the history of Europe, and you know, they're the defending champions of Pro 12, so the expectations are high on them. And you know, at the end of the day, they are winning. They, you know, they won a big game, and that's a tough game. And I know, you know, people are talking about the style and so forth, but at the end of the day, they won a very tough game, and they come here battle hardened on the back of Champions Cup rugby. So and in their home ground as well. So there's no doubt they're going to be tougher and better. And for all the reasons I've just said, the history is backing them, and home side, but you know, home team backs them, and the fact they're a quality team backs them.
And we'll have more from the Connacht squad in an hour's time. Finally, Davy Russell and Philip Enright are free to ride at the big Christmas festivals. The jockeys have had their 5-day bans for the whip borrowing incident at Clonmel earlier this month reduced to 2 days on appeal.
Darren, thanks very much indeed. The Russian ruble regained some ground in trade on Asian markets this morning, but it's unlikely to be anywhere near enough to help stabilise the currency, which went into free fall yesterday. The Russian central bank's dramatic decision to raise interest rates from 10.5% to 17% was meant to strengthen the currency, but it had the opposite effect. The ruble has lost more than half of its value against the dollar this year, hit by cheaper oil and Western sanctions. I'm joined now from Moscow by economist with Macro Advisory Consultants, Chris Weaver. Chris, you're very welcome to the programme. It's nearly 11 o'clock there in Moscow. What's the picture this morning?
It's very much a case of wait and see. The ruble market has opened, well, not surprisingly, nervously, but volumes are fairly thin. Nobody's willing to make any big bets until they hear from the central bank or from the Kremlin, perhaps, later today as to what they're planning to do. So the currency is more or less hanging where it closed yesterday. Yesterday it gyrated between 68 and 80 against the dollar. And right now it's trading just around 70. So it's very much a wait and see game for the moment.
Have you heard much from the Kremlin to date?
No, we haven't. And of course, tomorrow President Putin does have his annual televised Q&A, which usually lasts for about 4 hours. So we'll certainly hear a great deal from him tomorrow. But frankly, that's still too far away. People want to hear from the central bank or from the government today. What they have been saying is more or less sticking to the line that they've had, you know, for the last several months, which is that there will be no move towards capital controls or other restrictions on foreign currency sales. This is what they've been saying, you know, for the last several months. But clearly the situation in the last few days, even in the last 24 hours, has changed quite dramatically. And there is a great deal of speculation that, like it or not, they may be forced to capital controls. So this, certainly there needs to be some response from the central bank, either massive intervention to prop the currency or some other regulatory change. And as I say, now we're in this limbo waiting to see what happens next.
And I suppose when a crisis of this nature erupts, countries look to outsiders for help. But has Mr. Putin very few friends at the moment?
Well, he's very few friends with any money, that's for sure. There's nobody queuing up to inject money in Russia. But really, the problem in Russia is not a lack of money. The country's actually in very good shape, balance sheet-wise. This crisis should not be happening. And certainly from an economist's point of view, there is no reason for this crisis whatsoever. I mean, the currency is behaving as if it was 1998 when the country was bankrupt. And there were perfectly justifiable reasons for the currency collapse and the crisis. But right now, Russia's got a strong balance sheet. The weak ruble has fully protected the budget against falling oil price. The current account surplus will be doubled this year because imports are going down. Russia has a positive trade balance of $200 billion. So, you know, there's no financial reason for this crisis. It has come because confidence has completely collapsed. People are just fearful of the future. They don't really understand what's happening. The oil prices has been part of it. Sanctions have been part of it. But in reality, this is a crisis that's been brewing for several years. It's because Russia has not used this period of high growth, of high oil revenues over the last several years to change the economy. So we saw the seeds of this crisis from very early in 2013. Sanctions on oil have been the proverbial last straws. But, you know, it really is a crisis of confidence rather than a crisis of cash. So getting out of it will therefore be a lot more difficult. It won't be a case of just finding money. That's not the solution. There's going to have to be a whole process of rebuilding confidence and changing the approach. And quite frankly, that's going to be difficult to see how that's managed. And clearly is going to take many years rather than a quick bounce.
Can this be confined to Russia, Chris, or is there a concern that it would spread to global markets?
Well, it should be confined to Russia because there is no Russia's main role, if you like, in the global economy is as the biggest supplier of raw materials. It's the biggest energy producer and the biggest supplier of materials, other areas from iron ore, etc. None of that is affected. There really is no reason to worry about Russian oil production, gas production, or metal production or exports going down. Russia is not a big consumer of imported goods. It is selectively for some German companies and for some European companies, but in general, it's not. It's not like China or some other big economy where demand is important for the global. Russia doesn't have that role, so there shouldn't be. But clearly, you know, sentiment and people will worry about contagion. And this morning, for example, you saw weakness on currency markets across Asia as a contagion from Russia. So there's always a natural kind of fear that this could, you know, spread to other areas and people are being defensive. I think the one thing that, if you like, that we have in our favor, i.e. in terms of global markets, is that we're coming up towards the holiday season when activity will close down or greatly reduce. And that, I think the hope is that period of a couple of weeks might allow for some calming of fears, allow for some action from the Russian government so that we come back in January, situation may be a little bit calmer, but we clearly have a more difficult week to get through before we get to that point.
Chris, very good to talk to you this morning, and thank you. Chris Weefer there, economist with Macro Advisory Consultants, joining us live this morning from Moscow.
And is here again with Business News.
Rachel, thank you. And we're returning to the Russian ruble and the knock-on effects potentially outside of Russia's borders. Paul Somerville of Somerville Advisory Markets is here. Paul, the currency came back a bit overnight to 68 rubles to the dollar from around 80 yesterday. It's a bit of a reprieve, it seems. And as we heard from Chris Weefer in Russia, it seems to be a case of wait and see, but do you think it's a temporary reprieve?
Yeah, I would say so for the moment. I mean, these are truly extraordinary moves from Monday morning to now. You know, as your last contributor said, when a central bank puts up interest rates by 6.5% overnight, you can say that they have lost control of their currency. And that's what's worrying the financial market so much. It's not just the ruble. This is happening with other currencies as well. And obviously because of the huge fall in the price of oil. Don't forget one of the things. There'll be a lot of dollar borrowings by Russian companies and also Russian individuals, for an example, have a lot of dollar mortgages out. So, for an example, that's 50% extra on their mortgages or 50% extra on their borrowings in dollar terms just in 2 days. So some of the solutions would be maybe capital controls. Obviously, they've announced that they're not going to do capital controls. Every central bank announces they won't do capital controls just before they do them.
And that's so, keeping money within the country.
Exactly. So what they would do is they'd have to shore up the borders and you wouldn't be allowed to take the money out of the country. Now, again, it's not a fantastic move to try to solve this problem. So I think they'll try to avoid it if possible. One of the potential things that might happen is the Federal Reserve is meeting later today, and I believe the Federal Reserve might come out and make a very dovish statement about the world economy and interest rates, and I think that might help a little bit, meaning that they will say that they won't be putting up interest rates early next year. I think that might calm the markets a little bit.
Do you think they'll go that far? Is that a this a situation that the Americans will be keen to head off, or might it be a good situation for the US if Russia is under pressure?
No, I wouldn't consider it good at all. When central banks see the international markets in all shapes and forms under pressure, they like to dissipate that pressure. So I would expect the Federal Reserve to say something very dovish. Don't forget, this is just not a Russian crisis. The stock markets around the world have been hit very badly in the last week. For an example, the German DAX is down around 7.5%. Last night in the USA, it was the tech stocks that got hit the most. It wasn't just oil and mining stocks. So this is actually a general market, very nervous market at the moment. So I would expect the Federal Reserve to do something to soothe that.
The wider Eurozone economy is also under a fair bit of pressure. Will this exacerbate the situation?
Well, again, it does in one sense, but the ECB is really on, you know, in Christmas holiday mode, so we're not expecting anything from them till mid-January. They've got a meeting in January, and we would expect the ECB to come out with more moves about what they're going to do in 2015. But for the moment, I wouldn't suggest that they're going to be doing anything to do with the Russian crisis.
One of the issues that seems to be making the Russian situation worse is, of course, the price of oil. Usually, the falling oil prices are to be welcomed, but here it seems to be having extremely negative consequences across the world.
Yeah, again, in the longer term, we would expect it to be positive for the world economy. Low oil prices, absolutely, especially for the US consumer. But again, don't forget, this is all a consequence of quantitative easing. There's so much borrowing out in the marketplace. So many people have borrowed money, and when there's huge oil price falls, they mightn't be able to pay it back. So there's lots of stresses and strains in the corporate bond market at the moment. And that's what's making the markets unnerved. It's not just the fall in the price of oil. It's, are these people going to be able to pay back their money?
Paul Somerville of Somerville Advisory Markets, thank you very much indeed. Let's take a look at where the euro is standing this morning against the dollar. It's at a just below $1.25 and just around 79.5 pence sterling.
Audrey. Brian, thank you very much.
A report by the Oireachtas Health Committee on Concussion in Sport has recommended that any player experiencing or displaying symptoms of concussion should be immediately removed from play. The report also calls for more research on sports and concussion and a more consistent approach to concussion management across all sporting clubs and schools. Dr. Barry O'Driscoll, former International Rugby Board medical advisor, quit his role several years ago because of his opposition to the way potential cases of concussion were being handled, and he's on the line now. Good morning.
Good morning.
From what you've seen of this report, what do you think of its recommendations?
I've read through the report. I think, on the whole, they're very good. They're very solid. They're based on a lot of the knowledge that we've got, and they're based on a lot of the fact that there's an awful lot we don't know about concussion, and most of the research coming through about concussion is worrying, very worrying, and I think it's very solid.
Now, looking specifically at this recommendation for any player experiencing signs of concussion to be immediately removed from play, the recommendation also calls for a graduated return. What does that mean?
Well, the graduated return was advised by Zurich over 12 years ago, and I was the IRB's representative at this World Conference. And what it is, anybody who shows any signs goes through 6 days of gradually increasing their involvement. First of all, complete rest. This is the day after any signs or symptoms. Then maybe walking, then running, then maybe skills for their own particular game, and then bodily contact. Any sign or symptom in any of those days, they go back to the previous day. If it happens again, or if it's any significant symptom, they go straight for medical advice. It's accepted the world over. It is the standard, and they're quite right, Oireachtas, to put this in their report as a recommendation, and it must be followed consistently, I think. And when I say consistently, it would be good to see all the sports being consistent about it. And also, it's equally important that within a sport, it's consistent across that sport. So when the elite players are doing something completely different to what the guidelines strongly suggest, then this creates doubts in people's mind, and they tend not to go much further with it.
Is that a particular problem that say schoolboys or schoolgirls are looking at what happens at an elite level, and it seems so different from what might happen when they're playing sport?
Absolutely. correctly. And that's where we have got to get the consistency. They have got to be told to do what they see their outstanding idols doing as well, or else it throws doubt in their mind and they can take chances with it. And that is not happening at the moment, chiefly, I think, for commercial reasons, because it's professional and there's a lot of other factors at stake. In rugby, my own particular game, which is possibly the most obvious one in our part of the world because it's the biggest trauma game in our part of the world, and in fact it's second only to ice hockey as far as head trauma goes. And rugby have dropped their disastrous 5-minute rule where they took a player off showing signs and symptoms and examined him for 5 minutes. You cannot rule out concussion in 5 minutes or in an hour. It takes a lot longer because the signs and symptoms often come up much later. So if they've scrapped that, they've gone back to their original regulation. You come off and you do the 6-day return to play. That's great. Unfortunately, they've brought in a new category that nobody else in the world uses, called potential concussion. And what's happening now, what is potential concussion, Rachel? Every impact that happens in rugby is a potential concussion. So now they're able to take off the player with a suspected concussion, say, no, it's not suspected, it's potential. So we'll do the test on him. And this is confusing everybody, and it's this lack of consistency which is going to cost.
Dr. Barry O'Driscoll, thank you very much for taking our call this morning.
Let's get the weather forecast for the day ahead. Evelyn Cusack is at Met Eireann. Good morning, Evelyn.
Good morning, Audrey, and good morning, everyone. And it's a very mild day already. The temperature is about 10 or 11 degrees Celsius and could reach 13 degrees before the day is out. So a mild day, but a windy day as well, and mostly cloudy with some scattered outbreaks of rain and drizzle. Some fog patches around as well with locally poor visibility. Now, a few bright or even short sunny spells may develop in the east, but overall quite a cloudy day. And more persistent rain will be pumping in or pushing in from the Atlantic at times, especially into southwestern, western and northwestern areas. So overall, cloudy, mild and windy with scattered outbreaks of rain, and continuing mild and windy tonight. In fact, very mild tonight, temperatures not falling below 10 or 11 degrees Celsius. And the wind's picking up a bit, fresh to strong southwesterly winds. So tomorrow, Thursday, starting off very mild, cloudy and windy with outbreaks of rain. And the rain will turn heavy in all areas and push right down across the country. It's associated with a cold front. So after a very mild start, it will turn colder through the course of the evening, with temperatures of 10 to 13 degrees Celsius dropping sharply. And it will be cold tomorrow night with westerly winds, but too windy for any frost. Lowest temperatures tomorrow night, 3 to 6 degrees. And Friday looks like being a cold and windy day. In fact, considerable wind chill from strong and very gusty westerly winds, temperatures of 6 to 9 degrees, but feeling much colder in that wind. But it will be a mainly dry day, quite a sunny day, but some showers likely in the west and north. And Saturday, we'll still be in this cold air mass, so a pretty chilly day. Not as cold as Friday, the winds will be easing down a bit and it will be generally dry with sunny spells. And again, perhaps just a touch of frost Saturday night. But for Sunday and Monday, it's back into the mild air. It's going to be blustery and temperatures on Sunday and Monday, 10 to 13 degrees Celsius and staying high at night as well. But there will be heavy rain at times, especially in the southwest and up through Connacht and Ulster, with a risk of some local flooding. And then the outlook leading into Christmas, well, it's still pretty uncertain, so we're not calling it just yet. But for the rest of today, mild and windy with scattered outbreaks of rain. Good morning.